And the today we are going to continue the discussions, the committee discussions on the OHP recommendations. Before we get in to this afternoon section, which is management actions within DHS, we have a couple of announcements and clarifications. But Rick, why don't you handle that?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Just a clarification on the report that was handed out yesterday, inadvertently put into number 8 on page 4 that DHS was currently calculating some pricing on that. Look at the horizontal pricing of the prioritized list. That was incorrect. I understand, though, the Health Services Commission may be working on that particular item. So,
item number what?
It was item number 4.
Item number 4?
Cost containment. Item number 8 is on page 4.
Limit or exclude?
Yeah, the one of the suggestions that came out of the cost containment group was that we look at horizontally or looking at limitations within the prioritized list.
Right.
For example, like limiting physical health or PT and those kind of issues. And right now we don't have the Health Services Commission, is looking at that. DHS is not currently calculating that item. So wanted to correct that because we didn't want to put DHS on the spot in terms of having a number for us when they weren't actually directed to work on it.
I think Lynn could do that.
I think it was Representative Bates who made that error.
And then
in the few moments that he was actually here.
Well, he's older now, so we've got
to
forgive him.
That's the reason for me not to be here. You've had more errors.
Yeah, well, he's older now, so.
And then just one other, and I wanted to clarify, in this draft cost containment report, a lot of the work that went into this was done by Lynn Reed directly and then from her staff. I was able to borrow heavily from what they did, draft out a little bit further and have a lot of good reviews, so I want to make sure they get proper credit for that. That's all.
And I think that's very...
I screwed it up.
Very appropriate.
The now, Representative Tomei asked what my little tool was earlier.
Oh, be careful.
This is a thought evaluator mechanism.
Wow. See, you go down the aisle and you just, you know, knock it on the head like this.
Hello.
Works very well.
Oh, you're in trouble, Alan.
Works very well. Come to old, you know. We have some disjointed thought processes. So that we hear any, you know, type of outrageous comments or ideas, we know mostly where they will
come from, but we can evaluate them, critique them. The chair has to leave this chair at 4:25. So,
good luck.
Hey, I'm a happy guy. The
I think you're taking that guy with you, aren't you? Where's he going?
Well, I don't know, because I have to make a stop in the meantime. So with no further ado, let's call up the director of OMAP, Lynn Reed, and have her give a presentation on the work group's discussions, draft, I emphasize that word strongly, recommendations on management actions within OMAP itself.
Lynn Reed, Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. I wouldn't go so far as to call this a presentation, but I will be happy to walk through the proposals that are listed here, beginning on page 6 of the document, Management Actions Within the Department of Human Services. Item number 13 is a suggestion that there is an ability to improve collections from third-party reimbursement for our clients. This would be a combination of both doing a better job of identifying those clients who have third-party coverage, such as an insurance policy, such as Blue Cross, and also for those who have been identified as having third-party coverage, doing a better job of recovering payment from either cost avoiding or recovering payment from those third-party carriers who may be responsible for being the first payer. And there is always room to do better, and this is one of those areas. One of the things we've already put in place or have moving forward to put in place is an electronic means of billing for pharmacy claims to a third-party carrier if a client has been identified as having coverage through another carrier, and that'll go into place in June. And will mean that we will cost avoid. We won't pay for that pharmacy claim until the third party has been billed and made a decision on it. Whereas today we pay that pharmacy claim and then we go out and try and collect from the third party, and we're not always successful in doing that. We do have a unit that processes information that they gather related to clients who have potentially have third-party coverage, and they get about 1,800 referrals a month for our 400,000 clients. And they do the follow-up on that, make sure that they get the correct information in the system. We also have a unit that goes out and does collections from third-party carriers. And that unit right now has a number of limited duration positions that are helping them do the collections. Those positions are scheduled to end at the end of this biennium. What we found with the limited duration positions that they brought on board during this biennium is that they just about doubled their collections. They were collecting about $450,000 a month, and that average is closer to $800,000 to $900,000 a month right now. And they just had a high month in January of $1.2 million that they collected. And so it may be that you will see in an upcoming proposal a proposal to make some of those positions permanent in order to continue that successful effort. There are also out there, there are firms that will go out and say that, and look at identifying and collecting third-party payments. And they will do that for generally a fee related to the amount of collection. We have not explored those directly, although there is one proposal that was sent over to us, I think, by Representative Cruz that staff are looking at right now. I don't recall the name of the vendor who has a software program that's aimed at identifying third-party payers, and we're looking to see whether or not that has some feasibility for us. The other piece that I'll just mention is we're moving forward with the procurement for a new MMIS, and a piece of that also has to do with third-party collections in that process.
Lynn, let me Jeff, do you remember the name of that provider?
No, I do not.
Because we got the little 50,000-foot overview one afternoon real quickly.
And staff are looking into that specific proposal.
And we've also asked Rocket and Transpool Governing Board to look at it also. So
that was the one that was passed on to me from Rocket.
Right. So we're getting a couple looks at it. So,
all right. Number 14 was that we look at better management of hospital stays in the fee-for-service program. I heard in your discussion yesterday, as you were looking at management of prescription drugs for fee-for-service clients, that there might also be some opportunity if fully capitated health plans were managing prescription drugs for their fee-for-service client, that could broaden the things that they look at in terms of managing. We also have a contract with the Oregon Medical Profession, OMPRO, Oregon Medical Peer Review Organization, some such thing, to look at to do some prior authorizations of hospital stays, to look at some post stays in terms of the appropriateness of the stay. But that isn't management that occurs while the individual is right in the hospital. And managed care plans, some managed care plans do that kind of concurrent management. I would note that right now, in just looking at some statistics, the fee-for-service clients are in the hospital fewer days per admit than the managed care clients. Don't know exactly what that means, though. You know, there are different health statuses. In particular, we looked at, when you look at just the physical health, the non-mental health, you'd see, let's see, for the managed care plans, 4.28 days per stay. For fee-for-service, 3.8 days per stay. If you look at just the mental health diagnoses, for the mental health organizations, 9.85 days per stay, fee-for-service, 8.69 days per stay. And yeah, I don't know what that tells us, but it's something to look into as we explore this.
Is that diagnosis for diagnosis? I mean,
that's the whole range of hospital stays. It doesn't get down to the diagnosis.
Okay, because you're dealing with some different populations.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a mix. Those numbers I gave you have the same mix of eligibles in terms of the same weight is given to how many aged there are, how many disabled there are, how many children there are, but it doesn't get down to the diagnosis level.
Do you have that in days per thousand as well?
Yes, the days per thousand for physical health for the managed care plans were 850 days per thousand member years. For fee-for-service, 663 days per thousand member years. For the mental health diagnosis, it was 797 days per thousand for the mental health side and 112 days per thousand on the fee-for-service side. So that's got to say something about the delivery system when you look at the mental health one, because that's a pretty significant
difference. Can you give us those numbers again?
For mental health, 797 days per thousand member years.
700 what?
97. For fee-for-service, 112 days per thousand member years.
Fee-for-service wasn't getting into the hospital.
Well, that could be. I don't know what the dynamic is there. We'd need to bring in our folks in the mental health side of the organization to look at that and explain what these numbers mean.
Could you look at this, Annette? Well, she says, I mean, I'm not saying this is good in terms of medical efficacy, but in terms of cost containment, it's better to leave fee for service outside of mental health, outside of managed care.
On the other hand, though, if you look at the mental health billed amount, the fee for service stays, although it's fewer days, fewer admissions, it was about eight times as expensive in terms of the billed charges.
There's something wrong with those.
So, and that doesn't hold very well. I agree with you in terms of a number of days.
Yeah, the days per thousand numbers just aren't right.
And that billed amount was per admission, but the admissions are much fewer.
Well, per admission.
Yeah.
Was managed care again?
Which figure? The
days.
The days?
Yeah.
Let's see, just a minute here. Managed care, mental health, days per stay, or days per thousand, I'm sorry.
Days per thousand.
Days per thousand, 797.
Right.
Fee-for-service, 112.
112. So it was more expensive per person in fee-for-service.
It was.
Because each
is eight times.
Each visit was eight
right.
times as expensive.
Admits were very different. Managed care admits in the mental health were 81 admits per thousand member years. For fee-for-service, 8 admits per thousand member years.
At 8 times as expensive.
Right. Number 15 is improving the management of our non-emergency medical transportation program. We're required under the Medicaid program to provide needed transportation in order to get to medical care that's covered by the Medicaid program. And so that's what this is about. And it's a full range of types of transportation. It can be ambulance, wheelchair, van, stretcher car, taxi, bus, private car mileage reimbursement. Could involve air transport, you know, somebody going out of state for a transplant. We pay for that that transport. So it's a full range of things that are provided there. There's been a real effort over the years to expand something that started in Portland, which is a brokerage system, and we have a contract with TriMet to actually handle the non-emergency transportation. And they look at, in that process, through that brokerage, of setting the client up with the most appropriate means in terms of the physical needs of that client to access care. So many clients can use the bus system. There are others who may need a taxi. It depends upon the needs of the client. And we're expanding those brokerages elsewhere in the state where there is an interest to do that. But for those that don't go through a brokerage system, the authorizations are handled in the field offices, and they make the decisions on what is the appropriate transportation and initiate the reimbursement process for that. And so the suggestion here is that it may be possible for us to do some kind of centralization of that transportation authorization in order to get a more uniform application of the policies.
And this would be for the fee-for-service population?
Well, this is the full range of population, because the managed care plans are not capitated for non-emergency or non-ambulance transportation. So they don't pay for that. This is something kind of like mental health drugs that we pay for outside of capitation.
Run that past me again.
The non-emergency transportation, like private car mileage or taxis or bus, is not paid for by the managed care plans for their enrollees. OMAP makes those payments directly, just like we do for the mental health drugs for a managed care enrollee. It's paid in the fee-for-service system. There are a few other things that we pay for in the fee-for-service system for everyone as well.
Why would that not be capitated?
Originally, the thinking in terms of what was brought into capitation was that that was a non-traditional kind of service for an HMO, that the HMOs were used to providing more in the neighborhood, you know, the ambulance, not the kind of supports in transportation that you do in a Medicaid program. That was the original thinking, and it's been like that from the beginning.
But if I could just follow up, I think, on Representative Bates' question. I think that's an area we have to look at, because I know there is, and I'm sure this is for emergency transport, but...
This is not emergency I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I'm speaking of... Let me ask you this. Is transport from the hospital after the hospital stay is over, is that considered emergency?
Generally, I'd say no, it would not be. It would be, you know, if somebody was going home, perhaps if they were being transported to a nursing facility after a hospital stay, that may be, and it was being done by ambulance, that may be included in the managed care plan's capitation. There are some services, the ambulance services are all included there.
Yeah. This is an area we've got to look at, and I'm not saying it's a big deal, and but I'm familiar with one IPA that covers a fairly large area, and they have contracts with different carriers in different regions of this region, different areas of this region. One of them's capitated. One of them's, you know, on a fee-for-service basis. And one of them is kind of catch-as-catch-can, and they are endlessly debating the rates and if it was an ambulance or a stretcher car. And I'm going, you know, this is burning up a lot of dollars in the MHO. The contractors aren't necessarily getting any certainty in their billing. And I sat through a meeting, went through this whole thing about this, quote, egregious problem, and it was $1,200 over 8 months. And I'm going, you know, why are you kind of wasting my time and yours? And then I got to thinking, okay, that was the amount of money of the billing dispute. But the amount of time that the carrier and the amount of time that the MHO was spending on going back and forth was, I'm sure, many times that $1,200. So I'm not proposing a solution, but I'm glad you fleshed that out a little bit. Thank you, Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
Representative
Just a couple quick questions about this, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair. I mean, one of the problems with this program is there's been anecdotal stories about real abuse, and it has occurred. You know, people who insist on seeing a doctor in the next town when the doctor next door could take care of them, and if it was on their own dollar, they'd never drive the 20 or 40, 30 miles to go somewhere else and come back again. And I mean, it happens all the time. If you talk to drivers, they're just kind of shaking their heads. They're running these people all over town to do things. Those same people, many of them have no trouble getting out to do other issues in their life, but because it's paid for, to go see the doctor, go to the pharmacy, or go to the hospital, or go get some lab work, or go to physical therapy, they take advantage of it. One of the things I've thought is, why have we not asked for a waiver from the Fed saying, we're trying to get as much health care to people as we can? Did we ever consider putting that into one of the waivers? But more importantly, how much money do you actually spend each year on this service? I'd like to have a figure for that. I mean, if it's a minuscule amount, it probably isn't worth talking about. But if it's significant, it buys more people.
Well, it is a significant amount, relatively. I don't have the precise number with me, but remember, one of the things in the original pricing that we had done for mandatory clients was we had left out this piece. And so when we discovered that, we went back and put it in the middle box in the mandatory services for mandatory clients. And it was about $20 million total funds, so $8 million general fund for that population associated with this.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I think it's something you look at.
Now you're talking our language.
Yeah. Should never throw out numbers.
I'm real money.
I mean, we're trying to buy back pharmaceuticals for this group. We're trying to get them basic health care for this group. Most of them are quite capable of doing their own transportation. It's nice to have this, but most of them can do it. And we're talking about people who get nothing. I mean, it's the same old act we've looked at all along. One guy gets the ability to fly to Portland for his treatment. The other guy doesn't get any treatment anywhere because we haven't got enough money to spread that money far enough to pick him up. I think it's an equity situation. I would look at that seriously and ask for a waiver not to have to mandate that anymore.
We could still
and I just want to indicate right now, though, that make sure you're aware that it is a mandatory service. We did get it as an excluded service for OHP standard population, but for the OHP plus population, it is mandatory. But that isn't to say that it isn't possible to get a waiver in today's world.
Yeah, I think we ought to be a little cautious about it. Rushing off on that, because some of that transportation really means you either have the transportation or you don't see the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there ought to be a way to control it so that it's not somebody that can get in their car and drive to the market and then come home and get a special car to go to the doctor. But I don't think it's quite as questionable as you do, Representative Bates. I think there are some very important uses in this. I'd be a little cautious.
Well, you should look at
but
it.
But you're right. I mean, if it's that or not getting care, take the care, they'll figure out how to get them there.
All right, number 16, third-party administrator. This is a suggestion that we look at whether or not it would make sense to take the claims payment function, basically, that OMAP has within the department for fee-for-service clients and contract it out. Some of the plans are going to vendors who do that kind of business and purchasing it for about 3% of the value of their claims. Overall, our administrative cost right now is about 2%. I don't know whether or not there is, that's a cost saver or not. One of the things that I mentioned earlier, that we were going through the process of procuring a new Medicaid management information system. And that's a several-year process. They have completed the process where they've gone through, looked at the various options, made recommendations, and together with the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology, I believe.
Very good.
JLCIMT, made recommendations, and coming out of that process are moving forward with procurement of a new system. But one of the things that was looked at in that process was whether or not we should have a system where, instead of having the system within the department that includes the claims payment and other parts, we contract with a vendor to actually do that. That component, which would be a third-party administrator in that process. The recommendation was not to do that. It was to move forward with going out and finding a system that best meets our needs and adapting that for Oregon and keeping that function in-house. And that's the process we're engaged in right now there. Number 17, disease management. This one indicates that we do currently have a disease management program that we recently implemented, and that there may be the possibility to expand that disease management program and secure additional savings. It's too early yet to know what kind of results we're going to get out of the disease management program. We have a contract with McKesson, and we entered into that contract mid-October. There are three disease states that are in that program: diabetes, congestive heart failure, and asthma. We're going through a process of getting, we've just gotten our first quarterly report, but as I said, it's really too early to see the results on that. I don't have that with me. We're looking at savings of about 5% guaranteed in the contract, and that's reconciled at the end of 1 year for asthma, at the end of 1 year for congestive heart failure, and at the end of 2 years for diabetes. Also, a component of that contract is to do case management for the highest cost cases. The state of Washington has a similar contract with McKesson. They're about 6 months ahead of us in terms of when they started their program. Still a little early to know for sure what their savings are going to be, but it's looking like maybe a little bit better than what had they had assumed in the budgeting process. So that's definitely one to keep an eye on.
Thank you, Chair. Lynn, what does that 5% roughly equate to in terms of dollars?
Let's see if I have anything here on that. Well, the only little bit of information I have here is that our contract is about, I think it's a little over $4 million per year in terms of the administrative cost of the contract. And the savings, the 5% savings, will pay for that plus some additional savings, but it's not a huge savings beyond that. It's a real heavy administrative cost contract. You should end up with much better health outcomes at the other end, maybe not big savings if you're just looking at the bottom line. And there are complications. For example, our OHP standard clients, that are, this is for fee-for-service clients, who have been picked up in this program because they're diabetic. We have 4,000 OHP standard clients who have diabetes. But we no longer pay for diabetic test strips or insulin syringes. And for 13 days we didn't pay for insulin. We're not going to see the same, may not see the same kind of savings there as we work through some of those issues.
Mr. Chair, question.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. You just mentioned that for diabetics under OHP standard, you don't pay for diabetic test strips. Is that true for OHP Plus as well?
No, we do pay it for OHP Plus, but it's in that category that you're looking at trying to buy back, DME and medical supplies. It's in that category. If we're not able to buy back that optional service, then we wouldn't pay it for OHP Plus either in the future.
I'd like to share a story with the committee if I could.
We'd like stories.
I do like stories. I wish I had more of them to tell. I had breakfast this morning with a constituent who has multiple medical problems, including degenerative disc disease, diabetes, mental illness, and one other, fibromyalgia. And she took me on a tour of her experience through OHP, and she described herself as an OHP Plus member, and I'm not sure she's right about that. One of the things she mentioned is she had abandoned testing herself because she couldn't afford the diabetes test strips. She also mentioned that, among other things, that because of the lock-in on the pharmacy, that she was having a terrible time getting to the place she needed to get her medicines and to get back home, and she has over 20 prescriptions going simultaneously. So I think that must do something to the biochemistry of the body. And she talked about transportation, the issue that Representative Bates has raised, and how the challenges of, you know, it's almost a full-time professional patient, if you will, when you have that much going on in your body. And I just wanted to say it was, you know, we're here in the academic realm, in the management realm, and it was quite a, and she raised many issues that I'm going to try to get more specific answers to. For example, the test strip issue. I don't know why the heck she doesn't have test strip if she's on an OHP Plus, but it really brought home to me that when you're medically challenged, especially multiply medically challenged, boy, it's hard. It's really tough. And all these little pieces that we're wrestling with are part of the world that the patients are going to. Are going to facilitate or not facilitate their ability to obtain health care. And I'm not criticizing anything you're saying. I just wanted, since this is fresh in my mind, I just wanted to share with the committee that conversation over breakfast.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bruce.
Yeah, I'm surprised we didn't get to it in work groups, but this we never even had discussion over your contract with McKesson, and I guess it'd be informative to see what the contract is and what we're buying and things like that. As if we could get that information, I think that'd be helpful.
Yes, we can do that.
Okay, thank you.
It is a 3-year contract. It was competitively bid, but that information would be available to you. Number 18, eligibility screening. This is looking at ways to modify the eligibility screening process to help in reducing any situations where someone is ultimately not eligible for the health plan but has been made eligible, whether that is mistakes or an issue of fraud and abuse. And I know that was discussed quite a bit at the during the fifth special session with Senator Menezes' committee, and there had been a recent Secretary of State audit that was discussed there. And that audit was focused on basically the group of eligibles who are the OHP standard eligibles. It may be less relevant if you were to move over into the eligibles that are the mandatory eligibles who come in through different eligibility doors. However, I believe that those of you who are on Representative Cruz's committee did do a tour and went out to the central processing unit where the mail-in applications are processed that are primarily OHP standard clients. Very much a production environment. Those, you know, thousands of applications come in every day. Workers are required to process and make decisions on 250 applications per month. They have a high turnover, their entry-level jobs, because of all of the activities going on right now. Right now they have a vacancy rate of about 35%. And those kind of situations will lead to less accurate eligibility determinations. There was a package that was improved for some additional positions for a program integrity component to the eligibility, and they're just in the process of gearing up for that right now, where they'll be doing more profiling as applications come in, looking at those situations that look like they may be questionable in terms of the eligibility. But it's just the sheer vast numbers that are coming in and the numbers of staff that are available that lead to error rates in that program.
Ms. Kircher.
Lynn, as I recall, one of the problems noted by the audit was lack of Social Security numbers, et cetera. Has that been rectified?
Yes, as I recall on that audit, one of the things that was mentioned was that we didn't have Social Security numbers for people who are part of the case in terms of part of the household, but they're not requesting assistance for themselves. Yet their earnings would count towards the income of the family and whether or not other members of the family were eligible. Also, there was something related to the CAWM program, the Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical Program, and not having Social Security numbers for those individuals. In both cases, the federal government will not allow you to require the Social Security numbers. But one change that was made was to ask for the Social Security numbers. So to the degree that individuals will volunteer the Social Security number, great. Also, a part of the eligibility verification process is where they have some information provided is if there's a Social Security number there for someone where it isn't on the application and they can make that connection, they'll pick up the number from there and add that into their database.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Lynn, remind me how many applications a day your department gets.
I didn't get that information. I know it's several thousand that
a
come
day,
in.
Right?
A day.
Right. That's
the day we were there, there were 3,300 that came in.
Okay.
That was a little higher than normal, but not by any means a record.
Incredible. Thank you.
And so that's one of those areas where additional resources devoted to the eligibility process would yield some results in terms of more accurate and screening out those individuals who are ineligible. The last one on here, 19, was review of administrative requirements for providers and looking to see whether or not there is information that we require from providers. And I would assume that would mean both fee-for-service and managed care plans that we don't need to require that could then yield to a lesser cost for those providers. One of the things that we had looked at out of the OHP stakeholder work group but never came back to it as part of the discussion of that that group. I have it here. Was in a discussion about dental. Steve Petroselli had indicated that he could bring down the administrative cost in the DCO if we could look at some of the things that we might be able to not require of DCOs. And we did look into that. Now, we have more leeway with a DCO that doesn't provide the full range of service like hospital care. There are federal regulations. The Balanced Budget Act that passed in 1997, all of those regulations have to be implemented, and our contracts reflect them by mid-August of this year, and many of them are already in place. So the flexibility we have for DCOs, which is the info that I have here, wouldn't be as great with the fully capitated health plans. But some of the things we looked at for the DCOs were we require that plans participate. We have regional meetings where we bring the plans, we bring the branch workers, the field office workers together, the county health departments, and it's an opportunity to share information and problems and so on. We require attendance by our plans at those meetings. We can pull away from that. We require our plans to participate in external quality review organization studies in terms of the quality of care they provide. For DCOs, anyway, we wouldn't have to require that. We have quality improvement and performance measures that are in our contracts. For the DCOs, we wouldn't have to require that plans meet performance measures. We require plans to evaluate and certify the accuracy of their encounter data. For DCOs, we could move away from doing that. I mean, all of these things, as you can tell, have a purpose behind them. You weigh that against the efficiency, though, and the cost savings. We do annual site reviews of plans. We could look at, and although there's a requirement that we do these kinds of reviews, we could look at doing them less frequently. We have a requirement that plans have internal grievance procedures in order to handle complaints from their members. At least in the case of the DCOs, we wouldn't have to do that, although that isn't something we'd want to put on the table. There are requirements related to the plans looking at fraud and abuse. You wouldn't have to require the DCOs to do that, although I think we would have to on the other plans. Once again, there's a reason why you want them to do that. We require plans to report to us on a quarterly basis the complaints. You know, we don't want to see every complaint, but we want a report in terms of, you know, it's one of our quality monitorings. You know, are there access issues, quality of care issues? And we do that quarterly. You know, we could change that to less frequently. So those are some examples of things we looked at related to the DCO world. As I say, there's a lot less flexibility in the fully capitated health plans. And staff haven't done that analysis. And that was the list of DHS-related items.
Lynn, you mentioned the site reviews are done annually and also the complaint quarterly. What are the results of those reviews? I mean, do you see that in your annual review you request a lot of changes or in the quarterly reports do you see a lot of corrective action that you need to take?
We look for process patterns and use a number of different mechanisms to get to that issue. Look at things in terms of we have a client advisory services units where clients can call and talk about what problems they're having. Corrective action plans do come out of that process. You know, how frequently I'd need to bring in Judy Moore Peterson, whose unit is involved in doing those kind of reviews of the plans. Judy is the one who never got to present when we came all that great data in terms of outcomes. So if you want to bring Judy to the table, she can do a dual purpose here.
Well, it might be good. I mean, if we're doing a lot of that and not getting the bang for the buck out of it. I mean, I understand why you're doing it and what you're doing, but if there's not a lot of corrective action to be taken, maybe it doesn't need to be quite as frequent these days.
Make sure you get that one down. Two questions. One is, how soon can you get me this information? And then this is the information I'd like to have. How many, Lynn, FTE, what percent of OMAP's budget, and how many dollars does that represent? is dedicated exclusively to the fee-for-service population. I'm not talking about the processor up there on in North Salem that's getting an application
right.
in and, you know, does this person fall into managed care or FTE? But how soon do you think you can get that?
It's almost four now.
It's almost four now. Let's see, this is April 4th, right? we could provide that to you. Is next week soon enough?
Well, sooner the better.
Sooner? I'm assuming that the analysis can be done about by your Thursday meeting.
Thursday
today
would
is
be
Tuesday.
Delightful. But I don't need it back in committee presentation form. But if you could just get that to Rick.
All right. You know, one of the things I need a little clarification on probably in terms of the request is staff are not dedicated solely to fee-for-service or managed care, depending upon what their function is. Obviously, someone who's doing claims payment is you can probably identify as fee-for-service. Somebody who is doing policy and program management, there may be some crossover in terms of it being managed care and fee-for-service. So we'll need to make some judgment calls and maybe just tell you what those assumptions are.
And that's fair, and you're actually helping me with a question. I mean, obviously, where I'm going with this is you were in the work groups and we're talking about the fee-for-service population absorbing a great deal, or of the managed care organizations absorbing a great deal of fee-for-service population. What I'm looking at is, you know, how many savings can we get out of the department if managed care takes over, quote, that part, you know, managing of that part of the operation.
So now, and so you're talking about managed care really taking over the claims payment, et cetera, in that process.
And break it down. Because, I mean, some, I'm sure they would prefer not to take over. Some would be, I think, desirable that they do take over. And then I think what the committee needs to do is make value judgments, you know, talk with you, talk with the plans, figure out what works, what doesn't work. That's not a pejorative question against the agency or, you know, or the dedicated fee-for-service workers over in the department. But, I mean, we've got to make some fundamental changes here.
Mr. Chair, you're asking the question, how many fee-for-service, how many FTEs would go away if there were no fee-for-service? I think that's a sort of different.
But not necessarily. I want it broken down. I mean, some would remain. But I want to know what those categories are. And then, thank you. I mean, do some Barney Kentucky windage, you know, on, okay, we've got 25 claims payers, and, okay, 20% of the population is fee-for-service, so maybe five of those would go away if the plans wanted to take over, you know, claims payment, which I don't think they do. But that's the... Am I being clear?
I think so. It may be a difficult. It'll be a. We'll be able to do something. It'll be an approximation. It'll have some assumptions around it.
And that's great. We can look at the assumptions and go. This one's right. This one doesn't work. I mean, right. This is starting the process. Different way to ask the question is if the fee for service population was absorbed into the fully capped plans. How many FTE could be eliminated, and what would be that savings?
Yeah, but he said it better because he's the chair.
Yeah. Yeah. And Representative Greenlink is obviously learning this process, and some are not.
No, are we assumed to pay the plans an 8% administrative fee? You know, in terms when it comes to the savings, there actually is a real issue that needs to be addressed
yeah,
there.
No, yeah, I'm not asking that.
Okay.
Because that's got to be worked out with the plans, and I'm almost glad no one from the plans is sitting in here now. But
isn't Jeff here?
No,
he was just
here. The but I mean that's got to be something that's worked out. It's got to make sense. I mean, it's got to make sense in terms of being able to deliver the service. It's got to make sense, financially, it's got to make sense at the end of the day, in particular, to the clients.
Right.
But it's something we got to look at, I think.
And let's talk about FTE savings instead of elimination.
FTE savings, okay. Now, I was pausing there trying to come up with a more delicate.
And just one quick question.
Sure.
In this scenario, would you assume that the plans would also be willing to pay for retroactive claims? In other words, it's kind of the head. before, when clients come in to the program when they're new, particularly the OHP or the mandatory eligibles, they have they're eligible generally for 90 days prior to their date of application. If they would have met the eligibility criteria, they're determined to be eligible back to that date. And so we get a lot of retroactive claims that have to be processed. There was no opportunity for management of those services, and claims need to be paid. And we pay for those in the fee-for-service environment. It's been my assumption in this thinking that that wouldn't be something the plans would take on, but that may be a false assumption.
I think that hits a nail on the head as to exactly kind of how we've got to dissect it, but we've got to have that information to look at, talk with the plans about, see if that works. Do the plans take on 90-day prior eligibility?
We pay for those claims on the fee-for-service side. It's part of our fee-for-service expenditures for that period. And for OHP standard clients, it's not a 90-day period. In fact, in the future, it'll be a prospective period entirely for that client group.
So let me get this straight.
That's just costing of the services. It doesn't matter where it's done. I mean, it's the same pot of money.
But let me get... Hold on just a second. I'm a slow learner here. The managed care organization, one of those applications comes into that very dreary room up in North Salem. Actually, that room wasn't too bad.
Almost in Kaiser. So.
Okay, almost in Kaiser. That room wasn't too bad where they come in. It's where they process them. I mean, that place had 7-foot ceilings.
They had a lot of balloons. Did you notice that?
They had a lot of balloons and not very much light. That claim comes in, and it's determined that that person can go into a managed care organization. There is no 90-day prior tail, if you will, or head, however you want to say it, for that person.
There is none. The managed care is not liable for that previous period of eligibility. OMAP pays it
still
on a fee-for-service basis.
I'm talking about if they went into managed care.
When that application comes in, they're determined eligible. The way it normally would happen is they get enrolled. As long as that was done by a Wednesday, they'd be enrolled in the plan the following Monday. And it would be from that following Monday forward that the plan would have a responsibility for the care of the individual and payment of the claims. So it's always a person. The plan knows they have the client before they're responsible for the care of the client.
Okay, but that client who is determined eligible for a managed care plan, the department still has the 90-day head.
Yeah, it depends upon what eligibility group you're in.
But if you're in the mandatory.
In the mandatories, almost all of those have that 90-day eligibility, retroactive eligibility potential.
What you're getting at, then, that previous 90 days, even though that's fee for service, you really don't want to include it in their figure.
No. Nope.
Separate. Right.
Yeah, that should be separate.
Yeah.
And the administration of that.
We may or may not be able to pull that out by Thursday. We haven't looked at it from that perspective.
So, I mean, okay. I mean, I've got it clear.
Yeah.
Whoever is eligible has this 90-day head, regardless if they go to fee-for-service or...
Yeah. And most plans could pay those as long as they knew somebody was going to reimburse them for them, in terms of the processing of those things.
If all you're looking at is the processing, you can process them. As Representative Cruz indicated, somebody's got to do that.
Representative Bates.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Lynn, I think we need to kind of clear up some misconceptions I can see flowing out of this, just real quickly if we can. You have people calling in just to get on the plan with no previous immediate health problem. They just, oh, gee, I think I can get on the Oregon Health Plan, call in, get put on. They, generally speaking, I believe, get dropped immediately into a managed care plan. Correct me if I'm wrong here. But a lot of the calls you'll get will be from hospitals or other places saying, I've got Joe Doe here who's been in intensive care for a week, just got out, going to the floor, going to be going home, huge bill involved. We'd like to get him into the Oregon Health Plan now. Fee-for-service picks that up. And he doesn't actually enter into a managed care plan until he actually gets out and is ready to be take part in a managed care plan. And you somehow are separating those two groups, I would suspect.
Yes. Once again, it depends upon what eligibility group you're going to drop into. But for that group that's OHP standard, the 100,000 clients who do generally do the call-in to the application center, get an application mailed out to them. That group, now March 1, our eligibility rules changed around that group. But up until then, they get a date stamp on their application. And when it's mailed out to them, that was the date they called, they'll be eligible to that date. Now, it might be a month and a half from now before they're determined eligible and get enrolled in a managed care plan prospectively. In the meantime, if any claims were incurred during that month and a half, we would make payment. Then there is the hospital hold process that, hospitals have used. The chemical dependency treatment areas use it. Safety net clinics use it. They establish a beginning date of eligibility oftentimes when someone presents for service. And they have access either through a hospital hold process or date-stamped applications to establish that beginning date. You know, in chemical dependency in particular, although that's changed for the OHP standard now in terms of as a non-covered benefit, there was a desire to grab that person when that person was ready for treatment, to make sure that, they could start the treatment, and if the person was ultimately found eligible, they'd get paid for that treatment. Those would establish dates. For other people, they just called, got their application. It still went retro, but they might not have any expenditures during that time period. Now, the future for those 100,000 eligibles is that someone like them coming in from March 1st on, they won't get a date-stamped application in terms of establishing their beginning date of eligibility. It will be the first of the month following when that OHP Central Processing Branch has determined they're eligible. So it's 2 months out there before that person will eligibility will begin. It'll be a future eligibility period. There won't be hospital holds for that group. Then we have more of the mandatory eligibles who come in through the branch offices usually, have face-to-face interviews with a medical case or with a caseworker who's looking at what their eligibility and their needs are. It's those individuals who in that process, if they would have been eligible earlier than when they applied for assistance, as far back as 90 days, that they will establish a retroactive eligibility date for those individuals. And then a provider can bill us once it's in the computer system and we'll make payment.
You got a follow up?
Yeah, I'll make sure we're clear on this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I know this is very confusing, and until I lived through a few patients first, I didn't quite understand it myself. To make sure we're all clear, the real people who are going to be potentially in difficulty with the change is going to be the hospitals, because that's where someone can come in with a large hospital bill. It's a retroactive bill, and if you're in the standard population, that's not going to be covered now.
Correct.
And if you happen to be in the OHP plus population, there is a 90-day look back and probably pick that up for you, if I remember correctly on this thing. And the real problem with this whole thing is the 90-day look back for primarily for hospitals. There's not much really outpatient work that's been going on that's very expensive or a major problem for the plans if they had to pick that up. But to ask the plans to go back and pick up 90 days or the hospitals to go back and pick 90 days is a real burden for either one of those groups, although primarily the hospitals do this or are going to be doing it for the standard group. In the past, that's been covered retrospectively by the plans, or not by the plans, by the fee-for-service part. Mm-hmm. So even if we expanded managed care plans to pick up most of the people in managed care on an ongoing basis. There's still this flow of people in at one end that will probably need some fee-for-service coverage for, and to deal with those people coming in with a big medical bill from the hospital before they go into the managed care plan. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And you have to factor that in to the chair's questions, which are very pertinent, and that has to be factored in.
And we'll do our best to try and identify those claims. Since all of our staffing is done...
Identify the claims. Identify the FTEs that have to stay there to handle those claims.
Agreed. You know, there aren't FTE identified that deal just with those claims. And so what we'll have to do is some proxy of saying what percent of the claims that we process fit in this category, and then translate that into FTE to try and get to that issue. Part of the assumptions we'll lay out.
Make them simple, single-syllable words. I got another question. What can we do as a legislature to help you and the department function better, perform better? I don't. I'm getting tired of this word. You know, more efficiently, but so it's not necessarily an efficiency question. But what can we do to help you? And you don't have to answer that right now. The second list, five things come off the top of your head.
Yeah. We don't have enough time to fully answer the question, I'm sure. But
that's a really relevant question. I served on a group evaluating Medicare under CMS and the fee-for-service Medicare, and the findings of that group was that the agency knew how to operate a lot more efficiently than it was, but was operating inefficiently because of constraints that had been put on it by Congress. And I think I hear you asking that same question. Mm-hmm. There are some constraints we're putting on the agency where the agency really knows how they could
exactly
do better.
And I go to the application form, which when we started out was 4 pages, and now it's 10 pages.
And of course that comes, and that's a very good example of, you know, we have competing pressures. You know, one of those is you don't want to let anyone in the door who might not be eligible. And so you get an application form that asks more and more questions. Another is you want to make sure that somebody who comes in the door only has one door to come in. And so then you've got to screen for, you know, I was told that there are 21 different programs, eligibility programs, they screen for in terms of those applications that come in at the OHP Central Processing Branch. So there has to be enough information gathered to screen for each of those programs to get somebody into the program that they're eligible for. So there are things like that. There are other examples, you know, in terms of operating more like the commercial sector that we hold up as a good example of a better way to operate, but we're constrained from doing some of the things that the commercial plan might do, from having the same kinds of formularies that a commercial plan would have, or in some cases we've tried to do something like sole source incontinence supplies. And there is a commercial plan might do that as long as you have adequate means of getting distributing the needed goods and get a good deal on it. In our case, many times we're looked at as being, it's our dollars that flow out to the community providers. And you want to maintain those providers in the community, but that may not be the most cost-effective way to run the program, some of those kinds of things to look at.
Well, if you can, you know, get us some bullet points on that as it comes to you, and try to prioritize them.
I mean, that's a very interesting issue she raised. I wonder whether we can follow up.
Go ahead.
The single door policy. That's, I guess, the focus of DHS reorganization was to provide integrated field staff. Do we need to explore whether that's using up medical dollars because of that reorganization model? I don't want to get you in bed with your agency.
Well, and I didn't mean to lead us there with that comment. Some of that is not just the reorganization. It is issues from the federal government. They did an audit, and they said that, you've got folks coming in through the toll-free line saying they want an OHP application, but you didn't look to see if they might have been eligible for the TANF program. You didn't look to see if they would have been eligible under TANF rules before 97 or something. And all of those are federal requirements. Well, we had a simplified process. They called for OHP eligibility. We shouldn't have to look at to see if they're eligible for these other programs. But that isn't what the feds said. And so it's that sort of thing. Part of the reason is, for example, in one of those other programs, someone's entitled to 90 days retroactive eligibility. They don't have to pay premiums. They don't have the same copays. They have a different benefit structure now. All of those are important considerations in determining your policy.
Well, it's also, it's not necessarily that we've suggested they have to go through one door. It's telling them that they don't have to go to 9 different doors to get services. And that was, you certainly don't want to go back the other way, too.
But there are a lot of advantages to what's being looked at in terms of, an integrative way to look at the needs for an individual.
And, again, I appreciate Representative Greenlick's, issue in the one door. And I think Representative March has a good point when he says, it's just not one door, so it's not 12. Mm-hmm. But in trying to put together this bullet point list of what can we do to help you, again, the whole focus of this committee, what's real, what can we do within budget, what can the state do? I'd like to take a lot of the federal mandates, away as I ask for more of their money. That's not going to happen. So, Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say first that the problem of one door has been grappled with for 30 years in the state, and we are getting closer to it, but not there. The question, though, for this that's pertinent to this is it allowable by federal law for the plans to do eligibility themselves?
I don't believe so, but
I have a hunch it's not, but I'd like to see if that's the case or not.
Does Mr. Hetherington have an opinion on that subject?
As to whether or not it's allowable?
Yeah, the feds allow the plans to do eligibility determination. Well, we got to beat you up a little bit, so. I think it's a great idea. We'll put that into the report. Plans do eligibility. We'll do it until the feds catch us.
And then we can eliminate that layer of bureaucracy at the state level. The plans can take it on.
And we can give that money back to OMAP to help with what I do think, I saw in terms of, not that I saw a bad morale issue, but, I know you guys are going through Dante's third level of Hades over there. And we appreciate you. So.
Thank you. I'll share that with all staff.
Yeah. And some of those employees that were in that North Salem, almost Kaiser facility, I know you're trying to save money, Lynn, but you got to get better lighting in there.
Were they chained to the chairs?
Well, there were thumb screws that I saw, to the computer keys. I thought it was very good how they could, any other questions for?
I have one question. Are there any questions we should be asking?
May I get back to you with that along with the bullet points?
Sounds good.
In a confidential memo.
Yeah.
Pinned to the bulletin board. Confidential.
Yeah.
Anything we go to the order? We have a very daunting task in front of us the next couple of days. I would encourage each and every member to talk, you know, among yourselves and share concerns and good ideas. And I think this is a bad idea, you know, as much as possible, so we can arrive at a consensus as soon as possible. I think that's a key part of this process. Is that a indication you want to say something, Representative Bates?
Yeah, and just real quick, Mr. Chair. We are going to present a report to Subcommittee Ways and Means that hits the bullet points but does not put necessarily a price mark in each one of those. Is that correct?
I think we'll put a range.
Okay.
I really appreciate the work that the department did. And by the way, Lynn, you should know I bragged on you every chance I got. And this has been distributed to the committee on that, the 33 ideas and, you know, a dollar range, you know, feasibility and effort to implement. I mean, three key areas. I thought that was a superlative piece of work, and we appreciate that. So I think that's what the form of the report will take. We have this dollar range, you know, with a high degree of certainty. Yeah, the effort to implement is high, low, medium, and the feasibility.
I assume we bring it back and then really start hanging numbers up.
And then we'll start really dotting I's, crossing T's.
Okay.
Any other business come before the committee? Now, I thought we were going to get adjourned before Jeff got back, but I'll consider it the other Jeff. So we were successful. Committee is adjourned.
One out of two is not bad.
Yeah, one out of two.